The following is a presentation of Morning Drive Media.
Broadcasting from on location in beautiful, hot, and I guess still steamy Las Vegas, Nevada, this is the Knapsack Files. I'm Ken Knapsack with a wonderful returning guest. He's making his return to the Knapsack Files. It's been a couple of years. The show went dormant, and I could not bring him on when there was no show. But he's back. It is writer, comedian, storyteller, pro wrestling veteran, man of all trades, the wonderful Dangerous Dan Farron.
Why, thank you very much, Ken, for inviting me back. I, too, had gone dormant for many years before I returned to the show.
Right.
At least that's the way it felt.
It's okay to go dormant for a while.
It is, once in a while.
Dude, we're out here in Las Vegas, and it's so typical of modern society. We live in the same town.
Yes.
And we can't catch up unless we're in Las Vegas on a podcast.
Right. Exactly.
We're very modern men here.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I consider you a mentor for sure, a lamppost on the path ahead.
Wow.
You like sit up top. You do a lot of wonderful things and things that I do as well. And mm-hmm. I think we're similar. I might have been not the son you never had, but at least the third cousin.
I used to describe you as the son I never wanted. That's what the difference was.
That's perfect. Glad to make you proud, too.
Yes. Exactly.
So it's good to have you out here. You're a Renaissance man. And you just, as of this recording today, this will be released a couple weeks from now, but as of this recording today, 37th wedding anniversary.
37 years of marriage. And actually, if you include the 5 years we dated before, that's like 41 years or whatever. And I always joke that I said, the last time that I was single, MASH was still on the air. That's how long ago it is.
Do, 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 do.
Yeah.
How does that feel at this point?
Boy, you know, it's really weird. Time goes so fast. It feels like I say it's like in the blink of an eye. And, you know, one of the things I did this past week on Facebook was to pull really, really old photos and kind of like, tell the story over like a 7 day span. And it just feels like it was yesterday to me. And it's so weird to look at them. And, you know, I get up in the morning. Sometimes I go in, you know, you turn
Thank
the light
God
on.
You do.
Yes. You turn on the light in the bathroom. You go, well, why did somebody put a picture of Nick Nolte's arrest photo on my, oh, that's me. That's not, you know. But see, my curse also is I'm married to a woman who looks very young, who's actually older than I am and looks 20 years younger. She's 1 year older than I am.
Yeah.
And as I joke about with other, and this is none of what my curse is, that some of the other people I hang around with, the producers, the stories, whatever, they all look amazing. And, you know, Vandal Drummond, Kurt Brown, our friend, looks very, very young.
Oh,
and, you know, everybody's going, oh, they look so young, they look so young. And they go, Dan. Yeah. Okay. You know, I said, and I, you know, it's like everybody else still looks young, and I look like the old prospector painting for gold at Knott's Berry Farm.
Well, it's that white beard doesn't help. I'm a couple weeks away from a full white beard, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I'm also developing the Doonesbury eyes, which is something that I think I need to have raise some money on GoFundMe or whatever to fix my eyes.
I heard one said it. Look, I last year was so funny. I crossed that 40 plateau, and you would send me a message of, oh, young fool, only now at the end do you learn. You've crossed the 60 barrier, which
yes,
we can say proudly.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I love about you is that you changed my definition of that age, where you know you can work an iPad and all those things, but you're still pursuing the things you love.
Yeah,
you'll never let that die.
No,
you're an artist to the end, a poet to the end. And a storyteller to the end.
Well, you know, they talk about the great opera singers, the Pavarottis, all those guys. They still took voice lessons on the weekends. And there's a phrase, I don't know, is it in Italian, which translates to eternal student. And that's kind of the way that I feel. I never want to stop learning. First of all, you know, it's bad for your brain to stop doing that stuff.
Right.
I want to learn languages. I want to learn how to do new things. I want to research things. I want to do all those things. I have no intention of retiring ever. You know, and that's one of the nice things about writing. As long as you have your capabilities or whatever, you can write as long as you want to, you know. And it is really weird for me because in my mind, I'm still like 35 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then I start to run and then I realize I'm not 35 years old anymore. And I just recently decided running was something that I'm done with. It's not going to happen anymore.
Clap your hands. I'm good, sir.
That's
yeah, there's that saying of, you know, inside every old person is young person going, what the hell happened?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the rub. I mean, I joke turning 40, I get it. It's not old in the grand scheme of things, but I do feel like you just, a blink of an eye. I feel
it
22.
It is a blink of an eye. And it's really strange because, you know, also there's that great, William H. Macy, quote about, in my mind, when I look in the mirror, the world sees Tom Cruise, but in reality, when the world looks in the mirror, they see Howdy Doody. And, you know, I think I'm, like I said, I still have brown hair, everything's going fine that way, but it changes. And you know what? The best thing you can do is, this is the one thing that age has given me. And I truthfully felt I didn't become a good writer or even become good at anything that I was doing until after I turned 40.
Why is that?
I wasn't old enough. I hadn't been kicked around the block two or three times. Right. I hadn't had all these things happen. You know, when you're young, you know, you're in your 20s, you think, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Mm. By the time I'm 30, I'm going to do this. Boom.
Right.
And then in your 30s, you start to say, something's not quite right. Something's not maybe following the road that I thought it would. It's leading someplace else. And then, you know, by the time you get to your 40s, you quote a rock group that's older than I am, the Rolling Stones, and that is, I may not get what I want, but I'm going to get what I need.
Right.
And that's the way I look at it. And I think once also you start to let go of stuff and say, all right, maybe this isn't going to happen. Maybe I'm not going to play right field for the Baltimore Orioles. But it doesn't mean that other things can't happen. Right. And sometimes, you know, life takes strange roads and you head on down there and you have no idea. The Story Salon thing was something for me. Right. I've been doing that 17 years now.
And explain to those, and I think we mentioned some of the last stuff you're on, the Story Salon is a storytelling group and show in the North Hollywood area, Studio City.
Yeah. Actually in Valley Village. It's where we are now.
Right.
We moved us. Artsy fartsy Valley Village.
Yeah.
But what happened there was I had done stand up for many years, and I touched on this last time I was here, and wanted to stretch a different muscle.
Yeah.
And said, okay, I can make people laugh, kinda. Mm. You know, I'd like to see if I can tell a story and use long silences maybe for effect or dramatic things or do different stuff. Wandered in there, wound up being asked by Beverly Mickens, who was the founder of it, who I knew from doing stand-up, if I wanted to help her produce. I produced the show very similar to the way you've seen me do wrestling shows, which endears me and doesn't endear me to people, because I take it seriously. I mean, here's the thing: it's people are paying money to come in and see it, so I think you should put on a show put on something that entertains people. But I do take that kind of stuff seriously, and I can joke about it. And you've seen me on both sides of the fence on that. I've made fun of some things, and some things I have to crack whip on. You know, and with Story Salon. What's really helped me, and when you said in the very beginning that I've been sort of a mentor to you, I've gotten that from a lot of people, and that makes me really, really happy because one of the things, like I said, as you get older, you realize you're not going to get everything you want, and I have basically I was working a graveyard shift the other night. I was listening to the podcast that you did where you're talking about the things you liked and didn't like about being a writer. And the one thing that was fascinating to me was, and I remember this feeling well, this sense of urgency of I've got to do it now. I've got to do this now. I've got to reach it now. And I've, over the last 5 or 6 years, come to the realization that maybe something like that big may not happen, but at the same time, what's supposed to happen is going to happen. And if I've been able to, as cliche as it sounds, inspire people to do things or go on, I mean, you know, I enjoy doing that. You know, and to me, that's leaving something behind, even if it's not always your writing, but it's leaving something behind and something that someone passes down to the next people.
Do you talk about, it's easier said than done of, hey, you know, I got to accept some things aren't going to happen. Yeah, right field for the Orioles, just like I'm never going to catch for the Yankees. Mm-hmm. I'm convinced finally now, I'm 41, older than most managers in baseball. But as life changes and we talk about, hey, life takes you down paths and everything, how do you actually, on a functional level, start to accept those things? Because it's hard sometimes.
It's really, really hard. I was very, very lucky. And that is, as my mother used to say to me, when God gave out patience, he gave you two doses of it.
Right.
And I am a very patient man. On the other hand, you beware the fury of a patient man eventually.
Yes.
But I can, you know, I can sit through a lot of things and I right. can, and I have no problem doing that. And it's just one of those things that, that it comes with time.
Mm.
And there are these coming asunder lightning bolt moments where you go, huh, well, you know, because oftentimes in these situations, like with pro wrestling, when I've done that, I'm fully willing at this point that if I never involved physically in doing anything with a show or whatever again, I'm okay with it.
Right.
In many cases, people you know, who work shows independently, you don't retire. They just don't call you anymore. that's what happens.
Yeah, wrestling and comedy. Well, yeah. more wrestling well, than comedy. You can always do a microphone, get a microphone and do a set.
You can always do that. And, you know, you can always write and do that kind of stuff. But I found that it's so interesting because people say to me, oh, my God, you know, you work in storytelling. You've done stand-up comedy. You writing,
acting,
and wrestling, all this kind of stuff. And I said, but they all are alike. They really all are alike. They have threads that run through them that help you. And I think without having this wide, fishing net that I've cast out, without having that, I wouldn't be able to accept certain things.
Right.
You do just have to finally just to sit there and it's like the Alanis Morissette's video, Ironic, you know, where she's sitting on the plane and she's just like shaking her head like, can you believe this?
Right, that's
kind of what you wind up doing at some point. I can't believe this, but that's what it is.
Yeah.
And also, I think you have to be open to change. Change is really hard for a lot of people to do. There was a great quote on Mad Men many years ago. It said, change is neither good nor bad. It just is. Mm-hmm. And if you can accept it that way and do that, because you never know. I have a friend who recently was going through a real rough spot with his life and was a little bit younger than I am. Mm-hmm. Saw a lot of things happen. And there's that horrible thing, you know, and he felt really bad about this. He was seeing good things happen for friends, and there was that twinge that you get, you know, oh, my God, you know, can, you know, it's
good for them.
Good for them.
Clenched teeth.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, and he said, I just finally through that realized, okay, it's not going to happen, and I need to start moving in a different direction. And out of the blue, something happened, threw him back in that direction.
Right.
And now he's making a lot of money and doing some really good and interesting stuff. So it happens that way.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things is now that, as Roberto Rodriguez would say, now that we've snatched away this power with writing and self-publishing and podcasting and everything away from our corporate underlord masters, you know.
From the gatekeepers.
We do have a chance to older and do things longer. I mean, you know, writing, especially in television, is a very young man's game.
Right.
You know, I basically could have had two careers at my age at that point by the time they started looking at it. But with all the different niche type stuff they're doing, whether it's certain channels and all this kind of stuff, they're going to be looking for writers of different backgrounds and different, you know, different things like that. So you're going to wind up in that area. So I think that as an artist, now is a really good time to be an artist, you know, and people go out and they start their own series. They start their own stations. They take this kind of stuff and it goes with it. And some things work and some things don't. But, you know, the best thing to do is to keep throwing stuff out. One of my favorite quotes is from this movie called Gumball Rally.
Sure, that's
a movie. Remember Gumball Rally?
Oh, absolutely.
And
I got
there's
the poster.
A great scene in the very beginning where Raul Julia is getting into the sports car. The first thing he does is he rips off the rearview mirror and he throws it over into the back seat. And he says, the first rule of Italian driving, what's behind you is not important. And every once in a while, you got to break off that rearview mirror and go, okay, that's behind me. That's not going to do me any good, but I can keep going forward.
Yeah.
You know?
A lot of I think that's depression is living in the past.
Yeah.
Fear
of
the past almost.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard. Yeah. It really is very, very hard. I could sit here and tell you all these things you should do, but the fact of the matter is you're just going to have to go through them and experience them and see what. And every once in a while, maybe you hear my voice like Obi-Wan Kenobi in the background. Or, you know, I plan on doing stories a lot. I joke with the other producers that what's going to happen is in like 25, 30 years, it'll just be holograms of us, like in Superman 2.
Yeah, exactly.
Just sitting there saying, good evening, you know, and doing that.
How do you deal, as you get older, how do you deal with the concept of regret of anything in your career, close chances that you might have missed, you know, writing chances. I sometimes look back, if I had done thing, which is one of the hardest things to let go of. close calls.
Close calls. It really is tough, but you know, at some points you just have to let go. It's not something we want to do. But here's when you let go of it, you know, it starts to fade away. It becomes an ancient memory. And I'm lucky enough pretty good at letting things go and not letting things bother me. And that's something I had to work on for a while. Mm. Because I didn't want to be, I knew it was bad for me physically and mentally to be, and we know people, you and I both know people who get so geared up, who get so upset and so irritated and excitable over certain things that literally it's like a Warner Brothers cartoon. You see steam coming out of their ears, you know, you know, their eyes flip up and down, like, you know, the old things like that. You know, that happens all the time. But you just have to kind of let go.
Yeah.
You know, and it's hard. It's really, really hard. A little therapy never hurts.
Sure.
You know, I went into therapy and I wasn't really particularly, you know, didn't want to particularly go into it. But both my parents were dying at the same time and they both were dying of Alzheimer's. So as I learned about them, they were forgetting. You know, things were going. Father had Alzheimer's for 17 years.
Oh, wow.
My mother had it for 5 years, and they both had it at the same time. And I saw people come out of the woodwork and try to take advantage of them and try to do all this other stuff. And I've always, one of the things I always say to my wife on a regular basis is somebody has to be the adult in the room. And it's not always fun to do.
Said often in wrestling locker rooms.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And sometimes, as I taught you and Joe one time, is if you yell at people, they don't come around and bother you. Even if you don't mean it, you know, you just do that once in a while. So, but see, that's the whole thing, too. These are, you know, with the wrestling guys, like comedians, like anybody, they're, and I will admit that in the different portions of my life and everything, I react differently to stuff. Sure. I am very, very open and very helpful with writing people. We comedians, a little tougher because they have a tendency to be a little annoying at times. Yeah. I know that's hard for you to believe, but it's true.
Harsh reality.
With the wrestling guys, they're mostly kids. They don't really have any idea what they need to do. And I feel like enough people are blowing smoke up their butts already without me doing it. Right. I will tell you what I need. I will tell you what I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I will tell you what I want, you know, and I want you to do that. And if you don't do it, then I don't feel real trustful about using you in the future.
Right.
And so I'm much harder with people wrestling-wise than I am with people in other parts of my life.
Al, you've been in a lot of these different fields, comedians, and I love your stories of going to the Comedy Store in the 70s and wrestling. And you've seen some legends be built before you. What do the successful ones have that you've always admired and try to apply to your own?
Versatility. Yeah. I mean, the fact is, if you tell them to go left, they go left. If you tell them to go right, they can go right. They can do anything they want to. They don't. You know, they talk about brands these days, and I think that is very important. I mean,
sure,
you kids and your buzzwords, you know. But
get off my branding.
They all want to go that way, and that's really that's good. I mean, and that is good. But I also think you need to be versatile. As Chris Rock always says, you know, in stand up comedy. You know, the basket always counts for X amount of points, but the fact is that there's 40 different ways to get that to get that basket, and that's what it is. So you have to be able to all of a sudden say, I'm going to switch to the right or switch to the left. I'm going to do this. I'm going to try that. I'm going to do this. And that's what you have to do. And if you can't be versatile enough to do that, then you're going to have a problem because you become so structured, so rigid at that point.
Right.
That, you know, and we've talked about things, and I'm not saying anything. You've been very open and honest your stuff in life. Sometimes it's really hard to let go of it, and you've been pushing towards something for a long period of time, and all of a sudden you hit a brick wall. Yeah. And, you know, the hardest thing is to pick yourself up and brush yourself off and say, well, then I need to go this way for a while.
Easier said on a bumper sticker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Always that way.
Yeah. Talk about some fun stuff. You're a great.
Yeah, this is very serious. Yeah. I'm sorry.
This is also what I need. This is also what I like having you around for. You're a great storyteller.
Thank you.
If anyone out there listening can't pick up on that already. And you started storytelling at that higher level, mid-late 40s, is that what I'm saying?
Actually, I wanted to be a writer since I was 5 years old.
Sure.
And I think it was because for some reason, when I was in fifth grade, I started writing little sketches, and my teachers would let me produce and direct them, put them up on stage and whatever. And by the time I got to college, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write. I wanted to do that. And like anything else with writing, I've done technical writing. I've done script writing, novel writing. I've done all different types of writing, which you have to be versatile enough there to do. But I write stories. And then you know the whole thing what happens is then you read it later and you go, oh, this is crap. And you tear it up and throw it on the ground. But as I got older and I mellowed a little bit, I was able to look at things differently. I have never been afraid in a story on stage or whatever to make fun of myself.
Right.
I think it's very important to be able to do that. Because first of all, you don't run into trouble because if you're making fun of yourself, no one gets offended.
On the Schmoes No News segments, it's – I have a reputation justifiably for being a very, very self-loathing person. But I will say, exclusive Knapsack Files news here, I do that more often than not in this day and age to protect myself from making a joke that will get me Twitter hung.
Oh, yeah. And I've done it in real life, too. I've been very open to just saying whatever I feel, which is a good thing in a way. And when you're older, trust me, they'll allow you to do that more often.
You're the crazy old man on the corner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, they'll allow you to do that more often.
Oh, that's just Dan screaming.
But every once in a while, you just have to say, no, I'm gonna bite my lip on this one, you know, especially with bosses and work situations and things like that. You have to do that. But I think as I got older, I started to understand things. I started to see things. And I think it lent a richness to my writing and my performing that and also I love to take chances on stuff. I mean, I came up with things we do at Story Saw, like, for example, we do this every once in a while. This scares the hell out of people, and that is they don't know what they're going to talk about until I introduce them. So I'll say, ladies and gentlemen, Ken Knapsack will now tell you why he loves baseball.
Right.
And then, boom, you have 5 minutes to start doing it. I always tell people, don't just start talking. Let's see how the wheels turn. You know, we had a guy one time, we did that with a football, and he just started going, he goes, you know, a football is something I really don't like, and it's because it goes back to, and it took him on the journey.
Yeah.
And that is always, I love that comedy show called Set List, where you don't know your set list for your jokes until you walk on stage. They hand it to you, and it has four or five different subjects.
Where's that at?
It's all over the place. I've seen it several different places.
Oh, okay.
But that's the kind of thing when I see that.
That might be the only stand-up we'd be willing to do now.
That's what I said. I would say, I want to do that. Yeah. I want to do that. See, that's tough also because I watched guys like George Carlin go from, you know, a young hippie or whatever to old sage, and you watched how he changed his character from the hippy-dippy weatherman into becoming the grouchy old man standing on the porch, El Gran Torino, shaking his fist at you. And that's a wise thing to do because, you know, if he stayed the same character that he did before, you know, you have to make the adjustments. And I found as I was getting older, just in general with myself and with everything else I was doing, when I do stand up, I have to approach it differently. I can't come out and do stuff that Ralphie May or any of these other guys would do because it doesn't work for me.
Right.
And one of the reasons why I stopped doing stand-up was I used to do a sad sack character. Mm. And I got frustrated.
That's why you're my mentor.
Yeah. I got frustrated because of the fact that I no longer felt that way.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't want to do that anymore. You know, I didn't have to be the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah.
But I like to be somewhere in the middle.
Yeah,
you know,
a nice, comfortable middle, and then you turn again to this specific art of storytelling.
Yeah,
which I only had the chance to really do the one time with you, and then I got hired as a Schmoes producer in 2012, and life changed. And now I'm back to broadcasting on Wednesday nights with Schmoes. But it's on my 2017 goals list to tell a story again with you. It's a fascinating art form.
Yeah,
it is way more to me, and I say this out of respect to all the comics I know and love in my 10 years in stand up comedy. Storytelling is way more of a potentially fulfilling performance for me.
You know, it's really hard for a lot of comics when they come in to do it at first because there's a chance they're going to slip back a little bit into stand-up.
To the yucks.
Their show was originally called, before Story Slam, it was called Anything But Stand-Up.
Which is great.
Which the whole idea was to try to dissuade people from doing that. Because so many people are in the stand-up comedy relocation program on our show. What you would do is they would do it, and sometimes people would say to me, oh, it's no good.
Yeah.
And I said, why? And then they said, they're not I said, they're not laughing at you because they don't have to laugh. They're not programmed, but they come to this show to laugh at everything.
Right.
So don't go for the easy stuff, you know. Mm. I always say I admire somebody that gets up the first or second time and they tell some deep, very serious story. And and some people were horrified when I did this one time. I said to somebody, I said, you did a great job. I said, I can't believe your first time up you played the dead father card. And they were like, oh, my God. I said, no. I said, I'm telling them that usually people come up and they start talking about their childhood dog and, and how the first time I fell in love. And they ease into this thing. But somebody came up and, you know, one person came up one time and told a story about taking a bath and there was gunfire in the next apartment that broke through the bathroom in the wall or whatever. You know, that kind of stuff, you know.
I remember my story. You came up to me and you're like, great job. You really well-timed. Well timing on the playing the suicide card.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's you always had you got to play that thing.
Tip of a cap.
Well, I saw there was a storyteller recently that told a great story, just a heart-rending story about a dying pet. And you go in there, and you know what you need at some point when you do something heavy is you need that release laugh. You need some way to let the audience take a breath. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they went through this whole thing, and because the performer is Korean, mm-hmm. at the end of it, they said, you know, the dog passed away, and took a long pause and said, it was delicious. And I got the best release laugh I had ever seen. And we knew it wasn't real. We knew it wasn't. It was somebody playing with the whole stereotype and whatever and do that. But it gave, because you see people sometimes in the audience and, you know, people start telling stories and they lean forward and lean forward, you know. And
gets uncomfortable.
Taking a deep breath, you know, like that. And you need to do that with people. And that's always helped. You know, I've hosted the theme night that we do once a month. We vote on themes and do that. I've hosted that show for like 15 years. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've had one of the longest running MC things. And I feel like I'm pretty, I can feel that I can read an audience really, really well.
Yeah.
I used to get the people that would get worried that they were, they said, I'm not doing well. And I said, why? They said, you never looked at me. I said, I sometimes won't look at people because I want to hear. I want to hear the music you're playing. I don't want to see, because oftentimes, you know, you can do little tricks on stage, little winks and little things like that kind of, which will move the story and the progression. I don't want to do that. I really like to take long, uncomfortable pauses, sometimes with serious stories. And also, I'd like to tell three or four funny stories and then maybe one or two, you know, kind of snarky stories. And then all of a sudden, throw a curve at them and do something really, really serious.
Right.
That's the chance that you have when you do something like Story Salon or The Moth or any of the other shows around that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our people have gone off and won at The Moth and done other things like that. And it's a real challenge. It's something that but it's something that if you do it, I've watched people get up and hit it right out 2 or 3 weeks after starting. I've seen people come to the show for a year before they get up.
Right.
You know, and
checking it out.
Checking it out because they feel comfortable. And I, truthfully, that's what I usually do. I like to, if you believe the zodiac or whatever, I'm a Capricorn, and Capricorns move very slowly and steadily.
Right.
And I like to kind of take a look around before I jump into things, you know.
Before you get there, how do you set out to craft a story? You mentioned some of the science of it, and I know there's a certain science of it. What's your skills if I'm a newcomer?
Well, what I say to you is, I say, what if I asked you right now to take a piece of paper and write down the things that you want to talk about, things in your life that you want to talk about. And then I said, the most important thing, it seems really, really simple, is a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, it's one. There's a big difference between a story and a rant.
Right.
You know, and what you need is I always like to know my beginning, where I'm going to start, and the ending, of course, is very important. At what point do you get off, and how do you finish? But also, I'm a big believer of what I always call the tent pole in the middle. Mm-hmm. You need something in the middle that supports it. So, like, if I talk to people who are putting together a one-person show with 4 or 5 stories, I say, what's your tent pole story? What's the story that holds this whole thing up halfway through?
Right.
You know, and that's what you look for. You know, so and we have some people, their stories go long, because we're only talking about 8 minutes. We're not talking about long time. And, you know, you can always bring the second half of a story back. Mm. But you need to find your voice as you do in comedy or as you do in anything, what you want to talk about. Yeah. And then realize that voice may change as you go through. But, you know, you got to find that tent pole in the middle of your story that makes you follow through to the end.
What was the easier one to find your voice in? Finding a voice is difficult. Storytelling, stand-up, Did one and the same?
I would say
storytelling came later. So
stand up was a little bit harder for me because I never really considered myself to be completely successful at stand up.
Yeah, me too. I know what you mean.
I love stand up. I love watching stand up, and I love to put it up on the rack and take a look at it, see what works. And I'm really good. I worked really well with other comics. I think really truly where I would belong in that situation. Mm. And some of the most fun I had was with six or seven comics. That I worked with, we would sit around in a room and pitch things around.
Right.
And I was always found it easier to write for other people than I did for myself.
Right.
Because also I was into doing a character and doing something that was feeling less and less like me. But also, I didn't want to be just another one of those snarky guys that get up and says, you know what I hate about people? Because I think there's too much of that to some extent. So I never had any trouble running myself down, but I also felt trapped. I basically boxed myself in and wasn't had any way to get out of it. And, I felt that storytelling helps actually a lot of the stand-up comics who come in because what they do is they find that if they can introduce some of storytelling type stuff into their comedy. One of the things I was really good at when I was doing stand-up was I do rapid-fire stuff, boom, 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 boom. And that was great, but, it's great if you're doing a five-minute set. You can't do longer than that.
Yeah.
I had a joke I used to tell about the softer side of Sears, because that was on their ads for a long time. I said, until you don't pay your bill, and then you don't see the softer side of Sears, you see the ass-kicking side of Sears.
Right.
And that came from, obviously, having trouble paying the bill for a long time and doing that. And what happened was that joke was fine, but there was more to that. So when I could do storytelling, I could kind of fill in the circles and stuff and color outside the lines and make that work. And then it becomes even a better or even funnier story because of that. And like with everything in life, there's serious parts of it and there's not so serious parts of it. And, it's really hard. But if you look at stand-up comedy, the people that really in most cases are doing really, really well are most stand-up comedy today really is storytelling. Storytelling. I watched this Netflix special called Three Mics with Neil Brennan, and it just blew me away because what he did was he had three mics set up on the stage, and he would come out and he used to write with Dave Chappelle, and he would do these one-liners real quick, whatever, and then like for about 5 minutes, and then the light would go off, and he would walk over to the other side of the stage, and he would do a little longer form stand-up about stuff and whatever. And then when he finished, he went to the center mic, and he told the story behind that. And he talked about being one of 10 children and having a horrible father and all these things. And then you started to see where the first two sections came from.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And I was just blown away by that. I mean, I didn't. That's the kind of thing you see and you go, okay, I want to work harder.
Yeah,
That's where you can take competition and say, I'm jealous of that guy. Or you can say, I want to take this and I want to work harder to be like him.
Spurns you on.
Yeah.
Spurns you on. I find, too, with storytelling, obviously, it's like, say, the book version of a movie. You're going to have more time. And I think you can celebrate more in storytelling with stand-up. Comedy does not seem to work in short chunks where you're happy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, that's the story about Sam Kinison. They always joked about Sam Kinison when Sam Kinison was on stage in the very beginning, when you saw him in those HBO specials, whatever.
Right.
This was a man in horrible, horrible pain. And then all of a sudden, there's hookers, there's Playboy bunnies, there's drugs, there's alcohol and stuff. And the edge felt gone. The edge felt was gone because he wasn't really suffering anymore. He was having the time of his life.
It's the rock band thing. It's the first album's about the climb to success, and the second one is being bored and trapped by success. And that album comes years later.
Yeah.
At this point, and by point I'm saying at an older age in a creative environment, do you still set concrete goals? Do you still have? I mean, you have your book you're working on.
Yeah,
I said
goals, but I feel like at this point, again, I don't want to. I don't want people saying, "Oh, God, I can't listen to that old man talk anymore about this." But first of all, I'm 61. I don't consider myself to be old. I really don't.
You have redefined that for me in terms of just your.
I mean,
it isn't old anymore.
I set concrete goals with cracks in them.
Oh, okay.
And
that's interesting.
I set a goal, and I'm really serious about I'm going to do this and complete that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like Rogue One. I put something in the Death Star to make sure that if it's not working right, I can blow it up and move on. That's kind of what you do. So you do that because I think it's wonderful to have concrete goals, but I don't think it's completely realistic. And I think that you're basically winding up, you'll wind up going outside and just banging your head against the wall. Yeah. I mean, as a little kid, I never forgot this. We were in Atlantic City, New Jersey on the boardwalk, and this mother was with this little kid, and the little kid wanted something, and the mother wouldn't give it to him, and the kid dropped down to his knees and started to pull himself along the boardwalk and slammed his head down with each time he pulled along. And everybody was standing there horrified, and somebody said something. The mother said, "Oh, he does that all the time. He'll eventually stop." And that's kind of what I think people wind up doing. You can drag yourself along the boardwalk and bang your head all you want to, but, you know, all you're going to do is knock yourself out eventually.
Yeah.
So you need to be, you need to be open. You need to be able to go either way. Concrete goals are wonderful. Yeah. I think start out with that, but just be realized that nothing is written in stone anymore.
Yeah. I mean, for me, as an observer of your life and just knowing, this creative pursuit, which I hope never dies for any of us, you know, goes to the end, and our definition of success changes. I've already seen some of that go through where, you know, my 20s, I was like, if I'm not on Saturday Night Live, I'm just going to die. And, and then you deal with that. I am fascinated and eyes on you for looking of how do you deal with it. At 60, you still have a story to tell. Where do you go tell it? How do you do it? And you're right. It's easier now. Mm-hmm. Definitely harder years ago.
Yeah,
and they put you out the pasture and be like, who's that old guy in the back of the belly room at the comedy store?
Well, 100 years ago, I'd probably be dead by now because of the way the things that have changed. I mean, you see people live on. I had a great grandmother lived to be 100 years old. To show you where my sense of humor comes from, they sent a newspaper reporter out to talk to her a couple days before her birthday. And they said, "How does it feel to be 100? And my great grandmother said, "Come back in 2 days when I'm 100 and I'll tell you." So that basically sets up my entire family at that point. Come from a long line of smartasses is what it comes down to. It's just plain and simple. You just have to, and I understand, listening to your question, I hear the same thing from younger friends all the time.
Yeah.
And, you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And you know that there's a lot of stuff in there that's probably true in your life. Oh, but there's this. I guarantee you, there's a little portion in Ken Napstock right now. It's saying, "I don't know if I can do that." that's from the time that I've known you.
Yeah,
I mean, that's kind of what it is, and that's natural. You know, I work with a lot of old men.
Yeah.
I work with guys that are my age that feel like they're 150.
Yeah.
You know, they still, why should I get a smartphone? I have a flip phone. The flip phone works perfectly fine, This smartphone doesn't work. Well, because you're not pushing it right and doing it. There's something wrong with this phone. It's no good, you know. And, there was a situation where I took a job, and I won't go into great detail in case they're listening and have me killed. But I took a job, something that was foreign to me that I didn't want to do.
Right.
And suddenly, there was some frustration, as you well know, with this kind of job.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I said, there's a story in here. There's a lot of stories. And I started writing things on Facebook, and I started getting feedback from people.
Yeah.
And I said, this could be a book. This could be a screenplay. This could be a TV series, and I've actually outlined all three of them, and they're all three different. How I would do it as a book, how I'm doing it as a book, and how I'm doing it, how I would do it as a screenplay, and how I would do it as a TV series, completely different. It's amazing because you look at it, you go, okay, this lends itself to a movie, but this doesn't lend itself to a TV series. Because if you're going to go on for, and I like the British way of doing 12 for like three or four years, and that's it, and you're out. You can lay it out that way because you run into that same problem. There's a great episode of episodes with the Showtime series with Matt LeBlanc where they were trying to adapt this English series to an American series, and they wanted one of the characters to fall in love with the girl, and he goes, "But no, we don't do that." Because what do? Like 14 episodes tops. He goes, "This is American TV. If we run 3 or 4 years, we're going to do over 100 episodes. Trust me, we're going to need to have that out of two characters falling in love with each other." And that's kind of what it is. You find out there's different things that need to be dealt with, and that carries over too. You find in life that you have certain problems and you go, well, maybe this is how this problem is handled as a book or this handles that this way. You break them down in different ways. You always, you know, plan B and C are always very important. And if you don't have plan B and C, invent D. That's what I always say. You know, you always
call the audible,
you know, because you never know. And I just don't want to wind up frustrated. I've been frustrated enough in my life.
Yeah.
I don't need it at this point. You know, like I said, I looked at my parents who worked all their life to get to their golden age where they could retire and have a good time. And then you know what? Didn't work. You know, it didn't happen. So my feeling is have a good time now, but be smart.
Right.
You know.
Right. And then look, maybe you're setting concrete goals with cracks, but you entered a job you didn't like, and now you might have a great story to tell
in the next chapter. That's the whole idea. And that's always the best thing, I think, is about being a writer, is you sit there and you had this happen, and you go, this is a great story, and I can write this story. I know this story, and this is what's happening behind it. This is my frustration is channeling itself this way, you know. And you have this stuff lined up, and you see, the way I always work in my head. I'm sure you do too. You see little scenes, little vignettes, little clips. The talk show movie clip that you always see, or the award ceremony clip they always show. You see those in your head. You can start to form them, and you learn from that, and that's what really works for me. Is I do what I call an exorcism draft first.
Where
I write things out, I curse people out, I kill them, I dismember them, I do all this stuff, and I go, okay, that's great, I feel really good now. Let me go back and make this into a real workable story now.
The barf draft.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The barf draft.
Exactly.
Editing, rewriting. That's where a lot of my projects died.
that's hard. I still have a problem doing that.
Really?
Going back. Because the problem is that our babies are never grow up. I mean, you look at them and you always go, you're never going to completely be happy. I'm editing on the way to the stage when I tell a story still because I, you know.
Edit on the stage.
And there's been times when I've had stuff that I've written out and I look at it and go, yeah, it's not working because I can't read this. I have to tell it. And that's always the difference sometimes. And when you tell it, you can put more emotion into it.
Right.
Of course, when you tell it, then maybe you're not verbatim on the script, and then you get mad at yourself because you leave stuff out.
But
that's part of the whole process.
Yeah.
You know, I've always admired David Letterman, who we talked about last time, because he would take big, long, uncomfortable pauses. And I've done that with people, done it on stage, where I take a big, long pauses to let it sink in. I want everyone to, and it's like I look around the audience, and that's one of the best things stand-up comedy ever taught me. That is, you know, you never, this won't come on, this is a visual for the audience, but you know, you start off this way and you go that way and you go this way and you do that stuff. And I want to see the audience lean forward. I want to see some sort of reaction, and then now.
Right. Boom.
And then you go back that way.
Right.
And the only way you learn that is just to keep doing it.
Do it.
And not worry so much about, is this going to, and this is not any insult to you or your partner from that episode. Because I listened to it and I said, I sense, you know, managers, you know, something like that. And that's true. You do need that, especially if you want to push. Mm-hmm. And if you're a younger person at this point,
you want to
go for that because of the fact that there is a something stamped on the side of a milk carton for you. Hurry up on it. But when you get older and you go, okay, I can do this my way.
Right.
And maybe somebody might want to do it. I mean, look at also the way things are these days with the development of I watch Walking Dead, and I am absolutely amazed what they get away with compared to what on TV when I watched when I was a kid.
The Fall Guy.
But yeah, it goes farther back than that. but remember, the thing is that, you know, you look at that and you go, it's amazing what you're allowed to do and what people accept now.
Right.
You know, language and sex and violence and whatever.
Right.
You know, that's fine if you had that. You know, as long as you can be honest with that, that's really cool.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
You know, that's the whole thing, is not for, you know, for that sake, but for, you know, do it because it's honest and what's true to the story.
Yeah.
I have certain words my mother used to hate, curse words that I, you know, can't say to this day because I feel like, you know, if I say this on stage or whatever, my mother will sit up in her grave and go, no, like that. And
how dare you?
How dare? But every once in a while, you find you have a story that you have to put that word in, you know, or you have to, or something like that.
Because it belongs.
You know, it belongs there, and that's what you find is when you're doing what you're doing. Very shortly, I guarantee you will start at some point writing something because you want to. You say, I have no idea where this is going to go. It may be something that I can do, but maybe I should just write. And what helps me on that is I'm lucky enough to have a lot of literary life sites online or whatever. I belong to this this site called Hot Valley Writers, and I'm doing stuff for them all the time. They publish four times a year. And if I want to do a piece about watching them tear down a building, and how it affects me or whatever, they'll let me do that and experiment with that. And sometimes by doing that, you can see it leads to something else, or it might even lead to something commercial, you know. But like my friend who all of a sudden had his life turn around, deep down, I still believe that can happen. For me and for anybody else, you know. You know, and you know, I look at you and the talks that we've had over the years or whatever, and I keep seeing the iceberg because the tip of the iceberg is above the water. But underneath the water, there's a giant portion of that iceberg you don't see.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, you're getting close to a spot where you're going to start
sink a ship.
Sink a ship, exactly.
This is where we met, Jack.
Where you're going to have a bunch of stories that you want to tell, and whether they are commercial or not, whatever, that's not important right now. I have friends who write on TV series, and they write plays in their spare time. They're not going to pay them money or anything at all, or they write self-published books, or they do stuff like that because while it's great to write for money, and you know, I always consider a writer a hired gun. I have never been to the moon, but I'll write you a damn great story about the moon, you know. You do that, but eventually, every once in a while, you need to write for yourself. And it's hard, because I have friends who say all the time, well, you know, the thing is, I write to live. You just live to write. And I said, well, but deep down, that's all it is, you know.
I still think, I you know, there's a story inside me to tell, and I've got to figure out what it is. And I think part of it is, I'm not, the journey's still going. I'm not getting emotional. I'm choking on the pizza I had for lunch.
That's pretty emotional.
Yeah, that's right emotional. There. Actually, I'm emotional about that pizza I had. Lasagna pizza. It was amazing.
Oh, my God.
It was everything you would fear to have on pizza. But
I had
now your coffee.
Just thinking about it. May have been a gag reflex, actually, at that point, but.
No, I still think there's some sort of story to tell, but I just like for instance, in my day job for 17 years, and there's definitely stories to tell, and I entertain my people, and I get all, oh, you should write a book. I'm like, I don't know what the story is there yet for me.
That's what happens. Yeah. But what you do is, like I said, I started writing things down on Facebook. I'm going to tell a little 3-minute story. And I wrote a little something Saturday night about something that I did. And I was very flattered to have a writer friend write back to me and say, if you don't put these things down, I'm going to hire someone to hit you with a stick.
Friend in wrestling?
No, but again, all the stuff we all dabble in, it's all the same. But I mean, that's the same thing. And you'll find that from people, and people will say to you, hey, I like that. Or, hey, that's good. That works. And then you go, there's something a little bit more here. And you hang on to that and you set it aside. And eventually, there's that light bulb. You'll just go, okay, wow, oh, this would work this way fine. You know, boom. And also another way, like I said, if you take stuff online, I think I'm going to put together a writer page, which I haven't done on Facebook, where I can put stuff up like that and see what kind of reaction I get from people who are friends or who barely know me or whatever. You know, and see what works from there. But, I mean, that's the whole process. It is a process. It's an ongoing process that will be this way for. This is the most serious that we have ever talked
this
in our entire life.
This is good stuff, you know, and I think it's apropos after, you know, you had to sit there and listen to my podcast of me fretting over turning an age that was so far behind you. It is really, you had to laugh.
Trust me, when you turn 60 one day, you're going to turn to somebody who's turning 40 and just go, mock you.
I guess I already do it when I see someone's turning 25 that I work with, you know, but I get it. That's the process. But I was, 40 was a big number. Numbers are big.
40 is a big number.
Yeah.
40 is a really big number. I mean, it is. And also, it's just in our society, once you turn 40, he's an old person. He's done. I laugh because, you come here to Las Vegas, and all of a sudden, I'm a member of the 50 Club, where, anybody over 50 gets discounts. So, I'm more than happy to take that.
Sure.
It's like, are you writing me off at 50? Is that what it is? Like, nobody, I always joke about, Einstein was an old man before he
right.
received a lot of things. I said, and Billy the Kid was dead for 40 years by the time he was my age, you know. So you never really know, you know, what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But it, you know, you do what you can, and you just keep doing, you just keep going on. That's all you do.
Yeah. That's all, and that's
and the same thing falls for marriage too. That's the same thing.
Yeah,
my
yeah.
wife and I, we joked about that. Somebody said, "What makes a really good marriage for
yeah.
her and I?" And we were watching TV the other night, and somebody said something on TV, and I made kind of a Mystery Science Theater snarky remark, right. and she started laughing. And she started laughing so hard, she started to cry. Then I started laughing at her laughing, and I started to cry. So here were both of us sitting there laughing like idiots at each other.
Yeah.
And this is exactly the reason why we're married together.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's
is
what
that
it is.
Boiled down to a complicated journey, boiled down to one or two moments. Is that the advice?
I dated my wife. I listen to people all the time, and I don't care what age they are about marriage. And this is really simplistic because Mary Lou was my college sweetheart. I mean, if I had had to go through dating, you know, being with people and then breaking up with people and being in my 30s and 40s and the pressure and the peer pressure and all that kind of stuff,
sure.
it would have been different. But I remember this was very romantic. I turned to her after about 5 weeks. I said, "So, I guess we're boyfriend and girlfriend now, huh?" And she said, "Yeah, I think so." And that's the last time we talked about it. There was no great discussion or whatever. And then
no Facebook status change.
Then one Christmas Eve, I said to her, "Would you marry me?" And she goes, "Yeah." And that's kind of, but that's just one. That's yeah. that's not the norm. That's not really
sure,
the norm.
Sure, and it probably is a lightning in a bottle. Maybe I don't know.
But you've met her. You see, we're perfectly matched.
Yes.
I mean, we're both insane. That's what it comes down to.
I love it. I think that is that's what it is. Find the other person who's just as insane as you are.
Yeah. Find the insanity in life.
Yeah. I gave a speech at a wedding in February 2014. Not my words. I read a poem selected by the bride and groom, and it was about that we're all searching for the right person, and we're not. We need to be searching for the right kind of wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And exactly. I really do believe in that. Though I've given up the search for anything. kidding, Dan. Not kidding. Dan, we're here for a pro wrestling event. I'd love to talk more about pro wrestling, but that's even a darker thing.
We never get there. You know, this is twice we started to talk about that stuff. I'm having a great time though because it's a chance to meet a lot of these people who have given so much and entertainment wise and this is where I start to feel old because like I met a guy named Nick Kozak today.
Mm.
Nobody that's anywhere near my age would know who Nick Kozak is, but.
Right.
He's he's 69 years old and he goes surfing still.
Right.
Without him, there would have been no wrestling in Amarillo and Dusty Rhodes said without him, it may not have been a Dusty Rhodes.
Wow.
And this is what you talk about again. So you leave.
Yeah.
That's not a name that a lot of people know, but it's somebody who's left footprints behind.
Yeah.
And that's just as important, I think, as I get older, is I like to think that that people would look back and say, you know, this person helped me, that person helped me. This is, you know, because we all are here because somebody did something at one point for us. And that can be just as important sometimes as everything else.
Yeah, yeah. And that's specifically the point of Cauliflower Alley Club, which is what we're here for. It's a Pro Wrestling Alumni Association banquets and all the fun stuff. It's, you know, I love the big stuff. I love WWE. I love all the flashy lights and the WrestleManias in front of 100,000 people. But it's a different feeling here. Mm-hmm. You have to really, really love and appreciate wrestling for what it is, a great American art form that, you know, a lot of people just don't understand. I've given up trying to sell it to people. Don't
you
understand.
Can.
And to see guys in the room who, you know, worked in front of 40 people in Amarillo.
If you get it, you get it. If you don't, you never will. I mean, that's just the way it is. And that's the way it is with anything in life.
If you get it, you get it.
Yep.
That's what it is. And Dan Farron, you definitely get it.
Well, thank you.
I will continue to look up to you, even if you don't want me to.
Well, that's okay. I appreciate that. I mean, again, I just was so amazed we came here just to talk today. And it was like all of a sudden a very serious conversation. I hope we haven't driven people away.
No. There's life lessons to be had and everything. And we can make the big yucks or we can get serious. And it's you're a great storyteller, too, even in your answers. And I know people appreciate that here in the NAPSOC class.
Thank you.
And where can they follow you?
You can
follow
me.
Since you are...
real Dan Farron. No, I need to Twitter more often. I find I have a tendency to write jokes on Twitter a lot, which is fine. Yeah. I don't mind doing that. It's easier for me to Facebook because I need to have this a little bit longer of a form.
Yeah.
But I'm on Facebook too. I'm always open to new Facebook friends as long as you're not going to come back later and argue with me on stuff, because that's a way a lot of my friends have disappeared.
Yes. You know,
I always say it works. I got 47 acres. There's a lot of room to bury bodies. And that's the way I feel. But you can reach me on Facebook and on Twitter and through the Knapsack Files.
Yeah, and if you're out there in LA and you're listening and you want to see Story Salon, look it up.
On Facebook. There's a Story Salon Facebook group. You can find mm-hmm. out who's on each show each week.
Right.
And we've had some people of well-known and famous people, and people who are just starting out or whatever. We had, another guy you admire, Rich Scheiner, has been on the show several times.
Yeah.
And it just tells amazing, wonderful stories. And
he does.
I'm really pleased that we've tightened the show up a little bit. And I think that for $5, you can't beat this.
It is a fantastic night and venture, and you're going to get, it's not like a stand-up show where you're going to get a bunch of people in the same age group telling the same kind of jokes.
Yep.
And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but you get a lot of varied, varied storytellers, and it makes for a fun evening. And you had me once, you'll have me again up there.
I know I will.
I have bared witness here, the Knapsack Files.
And we'll
listeners.
Have all these people come out and see you.
That'd be even better.
So
that
that'll
would be better. Dan, as always, thank you. You guys out there listening, appreciate the support. Well, whether it's joking about frozen pizzas or learning life lessons from the aged. Love you, Dan.
Thank you, sir.
we do it all here.
Is this the delete button over here?
That's it. we do it all here. Thanks for the support. We have the Patreon page. You can find us on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter at Ken Knapsack. Use the hashtag The Knapsack Files to join this conversation and tell real Dan Farron what you think about his storytelling skills. That is all, folks. We'll see you next time on The Knapsack Files.